Thank you very much. My name's Mary Beth and I am an alcoholic. Before I get started. So I love how you read that and put she instead of he, because when I came into the program, especially when I read the chapter about two of the wives, you know, I was thinking of me, poor me. And my sponsor said, no, you can read that as he. And so change those pronouns to apply, to be applicable to myself. So anyway, thank you for doing that and introducing me as a she. I'm an alcoholic. I was a drunk, and sometimes I can act like a drunk. But as I said, my name is Mary Beth, and I am an alcoholic. I am the daughter of an alcoholic. I'm the sister of an alcoholic, the niece of an alcoholic, the cousin of an alcoholic, and the mother of an alcoholic. And there are a whole bunch of us that are sober because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'll be forever grateful for that. Thanks. We're just a big family. I was raised in Michigan, so I have a little bit of an accent. And I'm going to bring my favorite book up here. I'll tell you a little story about that in a minute. And some people still think I have an accent. I don't recognize it, but I am going to Michigan in August and I'll be there for 3 weeks. So I'll probably come back with more of an accent, you know, spending time with my sisters and brothers and the aunts and uncles who are still living, which aren't many. And now we're the aunts and uncles of all of our nieces and nephews and great nieces and nephews. So I've lived here in Virginia, the majority of my adult life. I left there when I was 17. I was out of high school and moved to Washington, D.C. with the Navy Department. So I'm not a veteran, but there was a program that they had then, and it was, they were recruiting high school and college graduates to come and work in Washington, D.C. And so that was the Navy. I was recruited by the Navy, and I did that. And they sent me to Fort Myer off-post housing referral station, and I found a roommate, and I knew nobody. I went all by myself. And I'm going to digress here, because last night, our priest, I'm Catholic, so our priest was talking about hospitality and that that's a virtue. And I took a test one time at church, and I graded really high on hospitality. And it wasn't anything that I wasn't surprised about, because I know that that is a virtue of mine, and I'm very grateful to God for that. But anyway, he was talking about that, and he's from Uganda. So he doesn't even, you know, you can hardly understand him. It has gotten better over the years, but he was talking about, the hospitality when he moved here from Uganda and knew no one. And he said, you know, that people were so hospitable to him, and how it was so welcoming and wonderful, and he couldn't even speak the language. And I was listening to him, and I went, you know what? I went through that too. I was 17 years old, and I went to a place, and I knew no one. And people were very hospitable to me and welcomed me into the fold, you know, and I had this job, and taught my new roommates how to drink. And, you know, I mean, it was very hospitable, but I thought I had to humble myself a little bit in order for them to be hospitable with me. I had to allow that to happen. So often people go, oh, no, I got it. I got it. I can handle this. So I shared that with him last night, and he went, you know what? That's right. He did have to be a little more humble. He says, so often I see new people in church, and you know, they're gone before I get a chance to talk to them. And he said, they're not allowing me to get to them. But anyway, I digressed. That didn't have anything to do with our program, but you know, it might. Being hospitable and being humble certainly has helped me in my recovery. So came in. What led me here was I drank too much. Did anybody else do that? And my first meeting, a guy said to me, you don't ever have to drink again. And I went, oh gosh, he knows I have to drink. He knows that I have to. I cannot not drink. because I tried to not drink and I could not. I could never get to that point where, I mean, maybe 36 hours, but you know, that stupid stuff. And you go, oh, I'm never going to do that again. And it just kept happening. So I'm from a big family. I've from seven siblings in the family. I'm the middle child. I have middle child syndrome. Want to make keep peace with everybody. But there were things that I didn't know this until I came here, but I was able to identify some things that would really hook me in with Alcoholics Anonymous from an early age. And I remember one time, well, being the middle child, you know, and then she had three more after me. So, and they came pretty quick after me. And, you know, you get your parent alone when you have seven kids in the family. It doesn't happen very often. And I was a Girl Scout, and which was really cool that they paid for, you know, for us to do those extracurricular activities, because I'm not from a real wealthy, you know, I mean, I feel I had a great childhood, but we didn't have much, lived next to a railroad tracks and, you know, but it was my life and I'm grateful for what I had. But anyway, so I'm the Girl Scout and I had mom all to myself, and we were asked to invite our moms. It must have been Mother's Day or something. And we had to write a little poem to our mothers. And it was my turn to go. And I got up, you know, it was at a church. I had to walk up some steps and go to it. The podium was up on the stage. I got up to the podium. They must have lowered it. And I froze. I couldn't say anything. I couldn't do anything. And then all of a sudden, I don't know if one of the people start clapping or whatever, and I exited the stage without having read my poem to my mother. And I was so filled with embarrassment and contempt for myself. And I didn't realize that I had had that contempt at such that, you know, I was probably in the second grade. I was just a baby, the poor little thing. And I didn't realize that that contempt drove me. And I thought, I am never, ever going to feel that again. And I did feel that again in my life, but you never would have known it until I finally had to surrender to myself. But, you know, so when I think back, it's like, boy, that there were things that drove me from a very young age. And you know, so we have a big family and, you know, lots of parties and, you know, a lot of drinking, but I don't feel like they made us drink by any stretch of the imagination. It's just what I grew up with, a lot of activity, a lot of talking, you know, talking over each other. And that was okay. I can really, I can be in a big crowd. It doesn't bother me. So that's because of the big family that I had. And I'm also really grateful for the three sisters that I have, because so often I'll hear women who come into the program, they say, I just couldn't connect with the women. And I'm like, I could, because I love women. You know, I'm so grateful that I have three sisters, and, you know, we've all been very close over the years. And so I was really able to connect with women. And plus at my first meeting, I couldn't get the door open, and the guy who opened the door for me, my sister had told me to say that I'm new for my first meeting. And she said, and so I told this guy I was new, and he said, let me get a woman. And I'm like, oh, okay. I guess he doesn't want to talk to me. And then the third meeting, so that was a Tuesday night. Then I went on a Wednesday. Then on a Thursday night, the chairperson, and they were sitting at a big table. I thought he was the president. And he said, at the end, they have a saying, if anyone needs a sponsor, see the chairperson at the end of the meeting and they will help you. So I went up to the chairperson and I said, I need a sponsor. I didn't really even know what it was, but I thought I needed one. And he said, let me get a woman. And I went, okay. Anyway, so yours, you know, as I did get a sponsor, and the one that I was with for many years, you know, she did share that, that was really good that that happened. They said, the women stick with the women and the men stick with the men. And I still say that. And I still see people getting into trouble, you know, by not doing that. But God bless us. You know, we're just humans and we have to, you know, our path is a certain path that we have to take. So I'm really grateful that those two guys recognized I needed to stick with the women. So I'm probably going to jump all over the place, and I hope you don't mind, because it's just going to be my own story, and it's my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and my own recovery and my own life. So progressed to high school. Yes, I drank in high school. Yes, I was already blacking out in high school. I was not a daily drinker, but I really liked alcohol. I used to steal alcohol, you know, and put it in your pockets. And anyway, so yes, I did get drunk in high school. And then, of course, I moved to Washington, D.C. out of high school. And then I had an opportunity to get drunk as much as I wanted to. So had a lot of girlfriends, because there were people from all over the country that had been recruited to come into D.C. And there weren't very many men, but there were a lot of women. And this is in the 70s. And we just, you know, it was just what it was. And so I had this job with the Navy Department, worked up from the Pentagon in the Naval Annex. And I don't know that I was, you know, I wasn't all the way down in my alcoholism, but I was a real good budding alcoholic. You know, it was really coming to fruition. And I really had a lot of fun drinking. I don't know, you know, I don't know that I've ever heard anyone speak from the podium and say that they didn't enjoy it from day one. So, you know, there was conviviality, talks about it, you know, and in the 12 and 12, you know, there was, you know, freedom. I didn't feel like that little girl who was so ashamed of herself as a Girl Scout, not being able to talk. So there were a lot of advantages that I feel that I had until I didn't have them anymore. You know, it just, you know, I think about even my late husband, you know, I think about drinking with him and we partied hard, but he wasn't one of us. You know, he just wasn't, you know, it was time to go to bed and he dumped that thing out where I'd have to let him go to bed so that I could go get another one. You know, when there were friends, once, you know, people start getting married and birthing babies, people stop. Oh, it's like, I can't drink that much. You know, I have to nurse my baby or whatever. I have to, you know, take care of the kids. Well, that didn't stop me. I just, you know, my disease progressed and progressed throughout my marriage, my career. I did go to school after I was in DC, moved out to Oklahoma. That's another whole story. Sometimes I feel like I read a novel about this girl who moved to DC at 17, met a Marine, and moved to Oklahoma with him, and then moved to Virginia, back to Virginia. And I'm like, was that me? Or was that some book I read? It was me. I'm not even going to go into all of that, because it was just an opportunity for my disease to progress and to get where it was before I came in here. So I'm, you know, living in an apartment complex where there were, when I'm in Richmond, a lot of people are familiar with all the shenanigans that went on between these apartment complexes and, you know, drinking and, you know, the guys had converted in the apartment complexes, converted their refrigerators to taps, you know, to beer. There were kegs in their refrigerators. And anyway, so there was a lot of drinking and a lot of partying. And it just seemed the norm. But what I realized is it was my norm. And I sought out others who liked to consume like I did. And there were other things that I were introduced to me. I mean, we're talking the 80s and the 70s. So there were other things that were introduced, but they got in the way of my drinking. So I'm grateful for that, I guess, because I'd probably be dead today. But I, no, Maybe not. I may not have been dead because I think God wanted me here for a reason to continue on this journey. But I met James and we partied really hard. But we were in a group of people that liked to, you know, it was always the social. It's like, when's the next drink? When is the next party? When is, you know, the next event? And, you know, there are things that happen when you walk around as a drunk and you're blackout and you wake up the next day and you can't find things like your car or parts of your clothing or, you know, all this craziness. You know, it's ridiculous, the things that I would, and then I'd make up excuses for it. It was just, you know, it was the alcohol causing the behavior. But then I came here and you told me it was this causing the behavior, because I did things even when I wasn't consuming. I was planning to get drunk. I was planning, you know, the meeting or planning the event, but I hadn't drank yet. So it really was my screwed up head that had the problem, not the alcohol that was causing the problem. Alcohol just made me feel better about the decisions that I was making. So grateful you told me it was my solution to my problem, because it just made me go, oh, wow, everybody does this. No, they don't. I'm the only one who did that, or maybe you other women in the room, but you know, it's just, you know, it was just a different path than say people, we were talking about going to class reunions, high school class reunions on our way here. And, you know, it's probably just a different path than I had with some of those girls I drank with in high school. May not have had the same path that I did. Maybe some did, but they may not have had the same path. So when things started going south, I was married. Oh, we got so drunk at our wedding. I mean, just super, totally ridiculously drunk that we were so drunk that when we went to the hotel after, you know, the reception, there, it looked like somebody had slept in our bed, and it made me really mad. Sounds like the Three Bears, but anyway, the bed had been messed up. And I went, I am not staying here. Smashed out of my mind. So God, poor James drove us all the way there to the hotel, downtown Richmond. We had to drive all the way back home. We had just moved in together that weekend. And then all my family was here from Michigan. So somebody was sleeping in our bed at our new apartment. Anyway, but we were so drunk. I slept on the couch. We didn't sleep together. And then we got married because I was on the couch and he was on the floor. It was crazy. But we were drunk. So that was the beginning of, I don't think I've ever even shared that from the podium. Just came out. So we like to drink a lot. And that's what we did. But as I said, when James, you know, was done, he would dump out his drink and I would continue. I was in a career that I traveled, oh, no lie. You know, I mean, what a perfect job for a, you know, perfect drunk. And I don't know why I was able to be so productive, but I do believe that this does happen to a lot of alcoholics. I'm not the only one who, you know, advanced in their career as a drunk. I just kept escaping. You know, it's kind of like I was told I have a lot of not yets, and I don't want to get those, so I want to stay here, but I don't have a DUI yet. And, you know, somebody told me that when I was on Hull Street, the cops were on Midlothian Turnpike or vice versa. So it's a not yet. I do not have a DUI. And one time from the podium, I said, I didn't lose a marriage. But I did. Remember that Oklahoma thing I was talking about? I married that boy. And so that broke up, you know, and it was because of our addictions and our alcoholism that broke that up. It was very quick. That's why I say I almost don't even remember it. Or did I read a book about it? Because it was all very very quick, and I was drunk through the whole thing, and so was he. Anyway, so I'm traveling. I would plan my hotels next near a 7-Eleven, because when you call room service and ask for 6 beers, and they ask you how many glasses do you need, and I would go, oh, 3. I was by myself. You know, I mean, that's the unmanageability. When my sponsor told me I had to write a list of things that were unmanageable in my life, that was one of the ones I had to remember. I would order, 6 beers. I'm there by myself. But that was never enough. I would have to go to the 7-Eleven then after those 6 with those 3 glasses sitting there. I didn't even use one of them. But I'd have to run to the 7-Eleven or some other type. I don't think Wawa was around back then. But anyway, so my hotels were planned around my drinking. Everything was planned around drinking and getting the next one. In fact, there was always a cooler in the back of my car right behind me. And Igloo, they have that little button. I think they still have that button on them. And I became very adept at, getting the cooler. It's behind my front seat, opening it up, getting the beer out. Always went to 7-Eleven and, with intention of I had to have a cup to pour it in. Or I would wrap a Kleenex around the can if I was drinking out of the can. But anyway, so I go to 7-Eleven, get a big gulp, dump the big gulp out, and put my, fill it up with my beer from my cooler back behind me. So trips going out of town and trips coming back. And they're still promoting me, through this. I don't know. It's just, I think it's that hospitality about me that, perhaps was able to continue advancing in my profession. And I did a pretty good job. And I'm really grateful for that, because now I'm retired from that company and I feel really fortunate that I was able to retire from them. So, keep drinking, the behaviors are not good. I don't, I usually don't tell war stories or horror stories from horror from the podium when it's mixed company, but I just said the words. So, I'm not trying to hide anything. I was not an upstanding wife. Not that, God bless them. I love you. I was not a very good mother. In between all this, I had a son, and he was born prematurely. And at my very first meeting, I remember somebody asking me, "Well, you didn't drink, because women were like, 'Oh, you want to have lunch?'" I'm like, "I don't think so." But anyway, now I can't even imagine not being with another fellow alcoholic. But somebody had said to me, "Well, you didn't drink when you were." Well, first someone said, "When was the last time you didn't drink?" And I couldn't remember. And then another woman said to me, "Well, you didn't drink when you were pregnant, did you?" I went, "Oh, no." Well, what's the principle of the first step? Honesty? There was no honesty within this body at all when I came into these rooms. I lied about everything. Because yes, I did drink when I was pregnant. I could not drink. So of course I drank when I was pregnant. And he was born prematurely. Of course, I blamed it on other things, other physical things, other maladies that may have been a direct result of drinking while I was pregnant. But I'm not going to say that's why he's an alcoholic. God love him. And my father was in the rooms as well. But anyway, that was just one lie that I had to overcome, because it was truths to me. I told myself lies. I lied to myself much as I would lie to you. So, and I believed my lies for a long, long time. Thank God for the steps of this program, which are in this book, which I haven't even told you about this book yet. So things were starting to go, go south. I was starting to feel that anxiousness within me where I'm going to get caught. Somebody's gonna find out. My husband already knew. I mean, coming in at 5 o'clock in the morning. He knew. And he used to say, and he even talks about this in the book, he'd say, why don't you drink out of bottles instead of cans so that you can see how fast you're consuming this? Great idea. But then my recycling got so huge that I had to start taking it all over the place because I didn't want anybody to see. And not everybody gives a crap, but I didn't want anybody to see. I'm thinking they're monitoring how much I drank. Another unmanageability thing was I had an office in my home because I traveled, and I always had an office in the house. So one time, this is towards the end of my drinking, and it was like 11 in the morning. It was a Friday. And I threw a beer in there, but I always hid them. I kind of put it up underneath the papers. Well, there were five in there at 11 in the morning. I went, what? I didn't even realize that I had already had five beers. What I remembered was going downstairs to get another cup of coffee. And 5 beers later, no coffee. And it's just, the ridiculousness of the disease that had me so tight in its grips. And I was in such denial. So I had to start looking at things, and I was starting to get afraid, and burying things and moving the recycling around, showing up for PTA meetings, because whenever I was in town, I always wanted to be the good mother and show up for, Zach's different events, and showing up at a PTA meeting smashed, just ridiculous stuff. My last national sales meeting, pretty bad behavior. I don't even remember where we were, but came home black and blue and been in, and I wasn't young. And I haven't even given you my sobriety date yet. I'll let you keep guessing. Anyway, so that was in February of the year I got sober. And I swore off. I was in the Miami airport. I remember that. I went, I cannot do this anymore, this behavior. I was a national account sales manager, going to meetings with sunglasses on. Everybody laughed. They thought it was so funny, And out of 180 salespeople and 10 of us were national accounts, I was going to get caught. They were catching up to me, even though some of them thought it was funny. I'm looking at the VP looking at me like with disgust in his eyes. And I would have been disgusted with me too, because I was, but I had to be, act like I was not disgusted, act like it was funny. It was pretty pitiful. It was ugly. It was really ugly. And then coming home and, I said, that's it. I can't do this anymore. So I think I made it through that day, probably smelled like a brewery. You know how it just comes out of your pores? I remember running into somebody after I was sober at an account, and he just reeked. Had a nice suit on, looked good, clean shaven, but he reeked. And I went, that was me. That was me. And, so I know it was catching up with me, but that was February. And my sobriety date is May 7th, 1996. And so I couldn't keep it. I could not. I made it 30. The next day by noon, I was drinking, I'm sure. So I made it one day, next day by noon. It would be 36 hours was maybe the most I could go. And I think it was, since somebody challenged me and asked me when was the last time I went for any period without drinking. And I think it had been like 15 years. And my son was only in the fifth grade. So he wasn't 15 years old yet. And I hadn't been without a drink and way before he was ever born. And so, just knowing that it had me, we are powerless over alcohol. I am completely powerless over alcohol. It completely controlled me. It was my solution to everything. complete solution to everything. So May, it was not, you know, May 7th of 96 was a Tuesday. You know, so my last drunk was a Monday night, probably into Tuesday morning, but you know, it's like, it wasn't even New Year's Eve. I don't know about you guys, but I drink every day. So it didn't have to be a momentous occasion for me to be having a drink. That just means I could start earlier. Like Friday was good because I was always in town, and we always thought like my monthly letter was always better with a good drunk. You know, anything I did, I always felt like it was better as I had more alcohol in me. Now I'm so much better without it. So it was a Tuesday morning, and I woke up and said, and James was at the table reading the paper. Our son had already left and gone to school. And I said, I need help. Magic words. I've heard others say that. I didn't know I needed help, but I needed help. And he's like, well, if you do, I do. And I'm going, it's not about you today. You know, it's, let's just figure this out. And so he had an older brother who was in the program. And I have an older sister who was in the program who sent me this book. And I have the original letter from 93 in here that she wrote to me. And she had this, somebody had put this goofy, this is how she mailed it to me, with this little cover on it. And I keep thinking I want to buy one of those leather covers, but there's just something about this goofy looking thing with this little ruffle around it. And I just treasure it. And it's a third edition, and I do have a fourth edition at home that I read with sponsees. But when we get into the bits and pieces, then I use my book, because I've been through so many 12-step workshops with this book. And this is the book that was given to me in the beginning. But anyway, so Sue, I knew I could call my sister, but she was in Michigan. My brother-in-law lived locally. So I'm trying to track down Robert. Robert is his name, and he's deceased now. And finally got in touch with Robert, and he said, call Intergroup, 355-1212. I think I've only called him one time, but for some reason, I still remember the number. And that's Intergroup in Richmond. And so I called them, and this is like it. Now it's probably, I don't know, 8:45 in the morning. And they said, oh, we have an 8:30 meeting tonight. There was nothing, I guess there was nothing back then on that Tuesday that was near me. So, oh my God, I cried all day long. At some point, my sister called me, and we don't know if I called her or if she called me, neither one of us can remember, but she was 10 years sober when I came into the program. And oh my God, our relationship today is just beautiful. But she said, you know, she gave me a few tips and said, you know, first person you see, tell them, you know, that you're new. Says you'll be able to find it because there'll be a bunch of people standing outside smoking. And she said, just go in and, you know, surrender if you can. So I, you know, probably changed my clothes 3-4 times and had been crying all day. And, you know, but I had to look the part. And thank God I, except that you did it, Dale. He sent me a message and said, dress to be from the podium. So I had jeans on, and I thought, oh, I better put slacks on, because I didn't want to come in here with jeans and offend anyone, since he had already asked me to dress appropriately. Anyway, so I changed my clothes. Today I did the same thing. You know, it's crazy. I haven't changed much, I guess. But I went to that meeting, and they were just so kind, and it was the old Courthouse Road meeting, and there were probably 80 people there, and they split into two rooms. You know, they did a couple readings, and they said, okay, anybody who's new, follow, his name was Jim. They said, follow Jim to the back, and they had all these folding chairs set up right up against each other, and so you were like, you know, and everybody's new, and, you know, you're sitting there like this, so you don't want to touch your legs to anybody else's legs, and you know, and they did step 1, 2, and 3. And thank you, God. So I went there almost every week when I wasn't traveling. And it was just focused on 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And that's, you know, it sounds like a dance, but you know what? It danced me into these rooms, because that is where I needed to be. I needed to be constantly reminded of 1, 2, 3 and who I was, and that there is a power greater than me. And it took a long time for me to not to surrender, because I was so filled with shame from my behaviors and so filled with fear that I was going to get caught and lose what I had. The little bit that I still had hanging there, I still had my job. My husband was still hanging in there with me. My son was doing okay. My family hadn't disowned me. You know, the people I worked with knew that I was in trouble. My boss one time said to me, she said, "You are so compulsive obsessive." And I was so offended. I wanted to do anything to prove that I was not compulsive obsessive. And now it's like, oh, who cares? You know, I am. You know, I am. And I have this that keeps me under control. You know, I needed this. I was just so ready for this program, and the program was ready for me, thank God. So I went to that meeting, and I heard, I felt connected, and I heard some things that night. And I swear, I really think my very first meeting is the reason that I've been able to stay here for 27 years, because I heard keep coming back. I know a lot of us share that. That guy looked me, there was somebody who looked me right in the eye, and he said, "You don't ever have to drink again." I already shared that. And I thought, oh my God, he knows I have to. You know, a few people asked me out to lunch, women. And I don't know, I felt hope. And I heard at, you know, 210 North Madison, one of the old meetings in Richmond, it's a very eclectic group and building. And I heard somebody talking about hope, and the guy who was chairing that meeting, he said, hope is hold on, pain ends. And I love that. It is so true. But I was so filled with hope that my pain would end, and it has. And if I have any pain today, I have my sisters who I can call and, you know, review it with and talk about these things, or my sponsor. And anyway, so I felt such hope, and he looked me in the eye, and then they asked me if I had a big book. And I said, well, how big is it? I have to say that because I remember saying that. And now today it makes me even laugh. But I said, yes, I have one of those. And when I received this from my sister, I read her letter first, and she had referred me to a couple of chapters, and the letter is still in here someplace. Anyway, one time I read it, but it's kind of long, so I won't read it. But, you know, she had referred me to a couple of places while I was PO'd. You asked me not to swear, so I'll just say PO'd. It just burned me up. This is 93. I mean, I am like working my alcoholism. You know, I mean, it was going to town. So I was not ready for this place at that time. But she was worried about me. You know, she saw the behavior, saw the addiction really taking a hold of me, and me losing control. So, you know, she was trying to do what, you know, what she felt was the right thing. I've never mailed a book to anybody, but I've purchased books for people before at a meeting, but they were already there. So I said, yes, I have that book. It's in a closet. I remember throwing it up in the top of the closet. And so I went home, and that same guy who told me I didn't ever have to drink again said, go home and read the doctor's opinion and more about alcoholism. And I'm a reader. I used to, you know, because I flew all over the place, so I'd always have a novel going. And I've always prided myself on reading from page one till the end of the book. I never skipped to see how it ended. So this was not reading in line. This was reading, you know, out of order. But I did what he suggested, and I did it that night because I'm compulsive obsessive. So I did what was suggested, and I felt connected. I didn't feel so ashamed. I was so filled with shame because it said that I have a serious illness, and it's my head and my body that's causing this. And I thought, wow, it just really, I mean, and then the whole more about alcoholism, I saw the things about, you know, like James suggesting that I not, you know, that I drink out of bottles instead of cans so I could see how much. I saw all those different suggestions, you know, like we would use those things to try to get, to try to make it right. And it never was right. So I really connected in, and that was my very first AA meeting. And I haven't stopped going since. I went in the 27 years, I went 13 days one time without a meeting. I've never gone 13 days again because this and my body started to get affected within 13 days. And I was like, why would I want to screw with that? You know? And that's okay. If I don't tell people who I sponsor how many meetings to go to, they do. I don't try to work their program for them. I just share what I do for me. And if they want what I have, then they're going to do what I do, or at least a their version of it, you know, because everybody has their own interpretation. So found a sponsor, and there's so many wonderful things. I've only had two sponsors. So Joanne was my first, and she was my sponsor for a good, let's see, 8-9 years. And then unfortunately she went out. She called it the ABC. She's back in now, but she called it the ABCs, Ambien, Budweiser, and couch. That's what sent her out. She said the Ambien, Budweiser, and couch. You know, she was later in life. She had a child, married a man 15 years younger than her, and which is fine. I thought it was pretty cool. Anyway, and it just didn't work. She, you know, it was too much for her recovery to keep up with what her life had changed to. And unfortunately, she went out. But when she came back, I was the first person she called. And I was at Blackstone, that Blackstone meeting, that weekend thing that they do. And so we'll never forget that. But anyway, so then I have my current sponsor, and I was kind of flopping around for a couple of years. But before I start flopping around, and Joanne was still my sponsor, I had worked the steps. I was trying to sponsor women. You know, my career really took off once I got, it's amazing the things you can accomplish when you're sober. And it was just, you know, things were going really well. And one Sunday morning, before I got sober, my husband had a 5-way bypass. 11 years, he ended up dying. So 11 years before he died, he had a 5-way bypass. I was drunk through the whole thing. I mean, just awful. I showed up late because I stayed at the hospital with him, and that night before the surgery, the next morning I showed up late. I almost didn't make it in time because I was drinking. You know, I had to get drunk that night after leaving the hospital, thinking about myself and, oh, what's going to happen? Anyway, so I was getting ready to celebrate 6 years. It was February, and he and my son were out playing basketball and in the front yard in the driveway there. And he came in and said, phew, I'm out of breath. And I said, hey, he's getting to you now, isn't he? And he sat down in his chair, and I had gone upstairs, and my son, we had had a big breakfast. And my son hollered, Mom, come here. Dad's doing something weird. And as I'm coming down, you know, running down the steps, I heard those sounds and those gasping, dying sounds. And my husband died. And I was not yet 6 years sober. And I didn't drink because of you. And I made it through that. Because of this and what was taught to me, that I can get through anything with my higher power because of that step 1, 2, and 3 that I did for years, step 1, 2, and 3. And I had God in my heart, and I have you in my heart, and I had sobriety in my heart, and I didn't drink. And my sponsor came over that night, and in fact, my home group was on a Sunday night and a whole bunch of them came over. And not that I really remember a whole lot, but I remember her and I standing in our driveway right near that basketball hoop. We're holding hands. And I'm looking up because I know he's in heaven. And I think heaven's up. And we just said, it's going to be okay. She just kept saying, it's going to be okay. And she had taught me a lot of things about prayer and meditation, because early on when I would try to meditate, I'd fall asleep. And I thought, I'm not doing this right. I just would fall asleep. I'd lay on the bed and fall asleep, fall asleep. She goes, you haven't had a good night's sleep or good rest for years because of your drinking. And she says, so that's what God wants for you. And so she said, that's okay. And then I did learn to pray and meditate, and I love it. I was taught to get on my knees in the morning, and I love that. Then I was having a hard time turning things over. I know how to turn the page in a book. And I know how to turn a page. I know how to turn a corner. I know how to turn this and turn that, but I was still trying to be in charge. And she said, so she left something in my mailbox for me. It was called spiritual sunbathing. And it said, imagine, you know, picture it like being at the beach. And, you know, you're sitting in the sun and you don't try to control the sun. You just, you know, put your lotion on and you lay in the sun. And you have, you know, faith that the sun is going to do its job. And I said, that's beautiful. But then I had to tell her, when I was in high school and my older sisters and I and all the neighbor kids, okay, so we had this two-story home and my grandma lived upstairs. And so we'd go up to grandma's apartment and we'd go out her window and we'd lay on the roof because we were trying to control the sun. We wanted to get closer to the sun. And she goes, oh, I can see you doing that. You know? But it still, you know, gave me peace that, you know, today I can lay and let the sun do its job. I can let God do his job. And I really, like, God was really there doing his job when James died. And anyway, you know, there have been a lot of things in recovery that I have about 7 more minutes. So there have been so many things that have happened since I got sober and that we get through, you know, and then you get to, you know, you're doing all of your steps and there are some, you know, there'll be some things on my fourth step. And then I would share it in my fifth step. And I would tell, you know, I told my sponsor, I'm going to share this, but I don't ever want to talk about this again. And I'm sure most of us in here have things I'm not ever going to talk, I'm never going to mention it again. Well, you might have to get counseling on that. I'm not talking to anybody. So then at about 8 years, just before 8 years sober, I was really still experiencing some grieving and having a hard time having my life go forward. I'm still wearing my wedding ring. And one time we were at a meeting and I was with my sponsor. I said, oh, did you see that guy sitting across the table? He was pretty good looking. And she said, well, why would he look at you? And I said, thanks. And she goes, Mary Beth, you're wearing your ring. If this guy has any recovery whatsoever, he wouldn't pay any attention to you. And I went, oh, you know, touche. Yeah, but she was right. So I had to, you know, to get past that, to be able to breathe on my own. I did, you know, she says, I can help you through the steps, but this grief thing, you may need to go and talk with someone. So this grief person helped me get beyond other things that I said I was never going to talk about again, and I never wanted to deal with that. And we were able to get through those things, much to my chagrin. I really fought it, but she said something to me. She said, do you want to have, my son was getting older. He was becoming a man. He was now in high school. And she said, do you want to have the same relationship with him and put that wall around you with him that you have with every other man in your life? I started bawling. It's like, fix me. Help me get past this. And so with her help and with the help of the steps and my sponsor, you know, I was able to get past that. I was able to do an eighth and ninth step. And you know, those bricks that you have on your shoulder that's just kind of weighing you down with different things that you keep to yourself. And it's like, I am never talking about that. It's lifted, you know, and it's gone. And I have no fear today. I have just love in my heart. And it's really beautiful that our program helps guide us. You know, and there were other times. I know when James was still alive and I had my spiritual ass up on my shoulder thinking I was all that, and I wanted him to read the big book so that he'd know me better. She's like, oh, for God's sake. And she goes, Mary Beth, I'm your sponsor. I'm not your marriage counselor. She said, but there are great ones out there. So based on my sponsor's recommendation, my husband and I went to marriage counseling when I was about 2 years sober. And thank you, God. Because then I lost him when I was almost 6 years sober. And the he had said one time, why didn't we do this years ago? Because our marriage changed. Of course, I had changed too, but he had changed when I changed. You know, we always say, it's so hard to explain. But when I change, those around me change. And we don't get it until we experience it. And if you can't explain it to anybody because they're not going to believe you. I've tried. And people tried to explain it to me, and I didn't get it until I experienced it. But so she gave me good, orderly direction, which came from our God. And I just, you know, love her. And now my current sponsor keeps me active. I, you know, love service work. I've done a couple of things in service. Somebody asked me last night, have you ever done state service? And I went, oh, I never aspired to that. Anyway, he said, oh, you, he said, I can see you doing that. And I went, no, I like, you know, community service, you know, we like sponsoring people and, you know, and I have done service, you know, at the district level and the intergroup level. And it's great. That's where Sherry and I met, was in intergroup. And when I was, I moved, so I sold our house several years after my husband died. And then rented for a while, then found a place in 2020, closed during the pandemic, but I now live in the city. I was in Chesterfield County for a year, pretty much my whole time in Virginia. And so I ended up finding a place and it happened to be in the city. So I'm looking for new groups to go to because I was in the same home group for 25 years. And Woodlake, it's the Woodlake group, way out Hull Street, almost to Amelia. And it was a 25-minute drive. And I was like, oh, woe is me, you know, 25 minutes every Sunday night, and, you know, but I still went because I had that 13-day experience. So I started looking for, yeah, there are meetings all over. But it's so funny how when you get, well, it's funny for me. I got sober in a certain place. And I just pretty much went to meetings all, you know, up and down Midlothian Turnpike and Hull Street because there were so many meetings. And, you know, eventually I'd, you know, go across the river and go to a meeting over there. But I had never been to Into Action. That's my home group now. And I was asked to speak in January of 21 by my contractor, actually, and who happens to be the stepson of my sponsor. And so I walk into this place and there were, you know, I don't know, 65 people in there. And the only person I knew was Sherry. And we knew each other from intergroup. We had to kind of figure out how we knew each other. And so, you know, I don't remember what I said because I never do. But anyway, shared and told them I was interviewing for a new home group and, you know, so them to be on their best behavior. So I did have fun and they were, and what I liked about them is I was so impressed by their activity in service. You know, they had their own CPC committee and, you know, they went to the jails and they went to the treatment facilities and I was really impressed by that because, I mean, I had done, you know, treatment and took meetings into Tucker's for 3 years. And, you know, I did do service, but theirs was like, whoa, service, you know, way out there. So I thought, well, that would be good for me at 25 years sober, you know, to get back into all this great service work. And, you know, it was a good group of people. And they had a lot of, and it was also very eclectic. meaning there were, you know, a lot of ethnicity in that room. And they came from Drayton and they came from Yale, you know, and those were the people that were in that room. And I just thought, that's a good deal. I think I'm going to keep coming back here. So then I talked to Sammy and I was telling Sammy about it. She goes, well, I was always told if you switch home groups, go at least 6 times before, you know, you make a decision. Well, they have 2 meetings, Tuesday and Thursday. So I had to go 6 times to both of them. And anyway, so I made the decision and joined in 21. So it's been 2 years since I've been active in the M2 Action Group. And I'm very, very grateful for them and grateful for the service that we do. And, you know, I'm on the CPC committee and we're really, you know, moving along with the VA. One of the guys who's on the committee with me is a vet, and he has just done some outstanding work with a VA there in Richmond. And he calls him, he has a relationship with the minister there who he calls Chappie. I guess that's what you call him when you're in the military. So anyway, I'm just so grateful to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be a member among members, and to, you know, just be here after, you know, an hour and a half drive. It was a beautiful trip coming up here. And I'm grateful that Terry called me. And when she did, I said, you know, I was all excited. You know, when somebody that you haven't heard from in a while calls you and it's like, oh, yay. And so I thought she was going to ask me to do something with her. And she goes, oh, I said, how have you been? She goes, oh, I wrenched my shoulder and blah, blah. She went on this story. And then she said, and I'm supposed to speak Sunday night. Will you do it for me? Never even asked her where it was. And I said, well, let me look at my, I said, well, I probably could, but let me look at my calendar. But I was in my car, so I had to wait and get to a red light. Open my calendar, not a damn thing on my calendar. So I said, okay, I will. And she goes, well, it's out in Madison. I said, where's Madison? I'd never even heard of it. So anyway, so that's why I'm here. But always looking for a reason not to. So it was like, oh, let me check my calendar. Nothing. You know? So anyway, I'm so glad to be here with you. And I met some of you at the Serenity Weekend. I was there and it was fabulous. And I hope I see you again there next year. So that's it from me.